I'm Soledad O'Brien, and on my new true crime podcast, Murder on the Towpath, I'm taking you back to 1964 to the cold case of artist Mary Pinchot Meyer.
She had been shot twice, in the head and in the back.
It turns out Mary was connected to a very powerful man.
I pledge you that we shall neither commit nor provoke aggression.
John F. Kennedy. Listen to Murder on the Towpath with Soledad O'Brien on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Yo, K-pop fans, are you ready? It's your boy, Bomhan, and I'm bringing you the K-Factor, the podcast that takes you straight into the heart of K-pop. We're talking music, idols, exclusive interviews, and even the real behind-the-scenes K-pop stories. Plus, you, the fans, you're part of the show. And you can get a chance to jump in, share your opinions, and be part of the conversation like never before. And trust me, you never know where we might pop up next. So listen to the K-Factor starting on April 16 on iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. This isn't just a podcast. It's a K-pop experience. Are you in? Let's go.
Let's go.
70% of Americans are living from paycheck to paycheck. Not black people, not brown people, everybody. And whether you're white, black, red, brown, or yellow, you want to see some more green. Can I get an amen?
Hey, this is Financial Literacy Awareness Month. Tune in to Money and Wealth with John O'Brien, a podcast that breaks down financial freedom in a way that's real, relatable, and rooted in empowerment. From rebuilding your credit to starting your wealth journey, I give you all the tools to rise.
I'm going to break down how the modern economy works. This is what they never taught you in school. You're not dumb and you're not stupid. It's what you don't know that you don't know is killing you, but you think you know.
To hear this and more practical wisdom, open your free iHeartRadio app, search Money and Wealth with John O'Brien, and start listening today.
If money is a taboo topic and nobody wants to talk about it, how can we be educated on something we're unwilling to talk about?
April is Financial Literacy Month, and Black Tech Green Money is where culture meets capital. Each week, I sit down with black entrepreneurs and leaders to share their blueprint for building generational wealth through tech, innovation, and ownership.
Once we know more, we can have more. One thing is we tell our clients is the more that you learn, the more that you earn, but you have to be willing to learn.
To hear this and more game-changing insight, listen to Black Tech Green Money on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everyone, this is Mimi Brown, and this is Two Out to Dina with Love. In this bonus episode, I'm sitting down with Dr. Brent Munson, a three-time Altadena council member, local historian, and proud Altadena native. His roots in this community run deep, and so does his commitment to preserving its legacy. We talk about the early origins of Altadena, the impact of redlining, and the barriers that still stand in the way of rebuilding. But we also talk about hope and what's possible when a community fights to protect its history and invest in its future. This is a conversation about truth, resilience, and what it means to love the place that raised you. This is To Altadena with Love. So, Dr. Munson, let's take it back to the beginning. Talk to me about your upbringing in Altadena and what made it so special to you.
Sure. As a kid, I didn't know anything different. It was just kind of where I grew up and went to church there, raised a family there. It wasn't really until I sort of broadened my horizons before I realized that Altadena had a reputation. You know, it was kind of the bougie place, right? And, you know, that's not how I remember it, but that's the reputation it had. But over the years, I've also been involved in all sorts of service in Altadena. Mm-hmm. And from the service perspective, you get to see a broad portrait of what the place really is. I'm sure you've heard that 81% of the black residents there own their homes. That's about twice what it is in places like Atlanta.
Twice what it is in Atlanta? I did not know that.
Yeah, wow. I think the reason I brought that stat up mm-hmm. In a question about what it was like for me being there is that it's all sort of intertwined. Mm-hmm. What was normal to me was a middle class and upper class a black community. And that's really sort of typified by some of those stats, those census tract stats that, you know, that kind of describe who we were. Most of my friends graduated from college. A large proportion of them also went on to do master's degrees or terminal degrees. And that was normal.
So that was, I love that. That was normal for the area. So let's go back. Let's talk about the early origins of Altadena and paint a full picture. What should people understand about how this community first came to be?
Sure. John Woodbury founded Altadena. At that time, it was mostly just open land. He bought an awful lot of land, founded the town. It wasn't until much later that we started to see a real black population, mostly in the mid-century, when houses became available after Fair Housing Act and so forth. So, that's sort of the real growth of African Americans. But the draw for African Americans specifically to Altadena goes back to Harper's Ferry. Mm-hmm. So John Brown led a raid of Harper's Ferry. The idea was to take, it was the armory there, was to take the weapons from the armory and give them to slaves and to allow them to fight their way out of slavery. Didn't go so well for the raiders. For the most part, most of them were killed. John Brown himself actually escaped, but was then executed. He was hanged. His two sons moved to Altadena. And so Owen Brown was his older son, who was also a very well-known abolitionist, sort of retired to Altadena. But that set the tone of Altadena as a place that was sort of friendly to, or at least had an understanding of the plight of African Americans. It didn't necessarily change everything in Altadena, but at least it created a beacon effect in Altadena.
So what time period was this?
That's 1800s. Matter of fact, the raid on Harper's Ferry is arguably the most important historical event that sort of sparked the Civil War. It created a lot of sort of paramilitary conflict between the Union and the Confederacy. And it was sort of almost like a setup for the Civil War.
So why do you think so few people know this story? Why isn't Altadena more widely recognized for this rich history?
So history is written by the victors. And so we have to understand what the fight is really for. And so if we understand that the fight is for power, influence, control of resources, control of labor, et cetera, then we understand why that history isn't part of the narrative.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so true.
Yeah. Altadena is sort of sandwiched between Pasadena and the foothills. So most people sort of think of it as an extension of Pasadena. And it's kind of the way that it was founded. But the folks that have been through there and that have lived there, I'll read off a few.
Yes, please.
Octavia Butler, Sidney Poitier, Jackie Robinson, the baseball player, Eldridge Cleaver, Hattie McDaniel, Jane Kennedy. There's a much longer list than that, but those are just some names that will immediately ring a bell. Those people all lived in Altadena and not, just moved in there for a year. You know, they lived there. Mm-hmm. And so that was it was a core of black culture and black excellence. If you can imagine, these people had addresses there. You can imagine who came in and out of Altadena. So Altadena was not an unknown place, but the history of Altadena is quickly forgotten in today's zeitgeist. That shouldn't be confused with it being forgotten by Altadenans who live there and people who are associated. So people who live in Altadena understand how special it is. People who grew up there understand how special it is. And also the county of Los Angeles understands how special it is. I think that when I was on council and I was advocating for Altadena, it was probably the easiest job ever, was just to bring up a need in Altadena. And it was addressed in one way or another.
You know, so in episode 2, we touched on redlining. But now that I have you here, I want to go a little deeper. Can you break down how redlining shaped the Altadena we know today?
So redlining was found to be unconstitutional nationwide. It didn't mean that it stopped. It just meant that the law was on the side of African-American families that wanted to buy. But it still took an advocate realtor to actually sell you property. African-Americans weren't allowed to have licenses, so there were no African-American realtors selling property in Altadena West or East. But a realtor named Vernice Roberts was sort of was a champion of equity in homeownership, and so she would set up ways for African-Americans to buy homes. I don't know if it was through straw buyers. I would assume that that's probably part of it. The history is sort of sketchy on exactly how she pulled it off. But she was instrumental in getting, you know, black ownership of homes. Now, the idea of East Altadena versus West Altadena, anyone who grew up there like me knows that West Altadena is the black side of town and East Altadena is not. That hasn't always been the case. So some of the early development was in West Altadena, and that's where white families were allowed to settle. In East Altadena, black families were there, but in a sort of a less developed area. At a certain point in history, and it's hard to figure out exactly how this happened, but we can kind of guess, whites started to move east and take the larger undeveloped areas and make larger, more palatial estates and larger lots, leaving the West Altadena area for the African-American population.
So switching gears just a little bit, we know historically black families face more hurdles when it comes to rebuilding after disasters. What do you think lies ahead for Altadena?
Sure. So if we just try to build back the way that we have, we can create what the narrative talks about as generational wealth. So the idea of 81% of African Americans owning their homes in West Altadena, that's a narrative of generational wealth that doesn't exist in other places. But really, when we talk about black generational wealth, what we're really talking about is black generational not struggling, right? So I have a very low standard for what wealth is. I say if you can sustain your way of life without having to work, then you're wealthy. That's a very low standard. But most people who own their own homes in Altadena aren't in that category. So they're not really wealthy. Now there's an opportunity for wealth if the African American or anyone in that area who is now redeveloping can realize the types of increased value that a developer would if they get their hands on your lot. The highest and best use of a lot is the maximizing of it as a financial asset. And so that is, I think, central to this redevelopment effort is educating and providing the resources to allow people who own property to elevate their property to highest and best use, as opposed to just building back what was there and then trying to beat off developers who are hungry to take that property and develop it to highest and best use. Understanding the difference between restoration and reimagination is the key.
So yeah, that's the key. So, okay, let's talk solutions now. What, in your view, is the best way to build generational wealth in a community like Altadena?
If generational wealth is your primary goal, then the idea here is how do I maximize the value of this real estate? So in other words, if you have a single family home and you, instead of just building back a single family home, you build back four single family homes, then you have more value. So just to give you, I'll give you a quick example.
Yeah.
You have a single family home, on a lot, single family lot. You use SB9 to split that lot into two. Now you have two lots that can each hold a home and an ADU. And when people think of ADUs, they think of a converted garage, but it doesn't have to be that way. You can have a 1200 square foot ADU.
Oh, wow.
It can be attached to your home or detached. So now you have four units at 1200 square feet or so. And through Davis Sterling, or should the Altadena be able to through the county, adopt SB10 or AB1033, ways to split those ADUs off and give them their own APN numbers.
Mm-hmm.
If you have four separate pieces of property with its own APN, you can borrow against them HELOC style and use that money to invest in real estate other places without selling them. So you still hold on to all your property. You have more utility because more people can live there. And you also have access to cash, say $1.5 million to invest in real estate elsewhere. You could buy 10 condos in Baltimore for that.
You definitely could. So let's talk about that, because there's been a lot of talk about developers who are eyeing Altadena. And with all this history and the legacy on the line, how do you make sure that Altadena is protected?
So I think that choice has to be given. Some people want to recover the rich history of single family home with a barbecue in the back. That's how they grew up and that's what they want to restore. And that's valid. But there's another part of the history, which is the economic power that comes with land ownership. And each person has to make up their mind for themselves what's the, you know, what their goal is. Mm-hmm. But if you're looking for a way to maximize your family's generational financial security or move it towards wealth, then you have to maximize the value of your real estate through development. Mm-hmm. Most people can't become a developer. If there's a lot of, you know, learning that has to happen and you have to have a good team. So part of this process has to be providing resources to support people who decide that they want to go the development route rather than selling to a developer.
So what would you say are some of the biggest challenges Altadena faces when it comes to rebuilding?
I think that we perish for lack of knowledge. And that's not a dig on Altadena. That's a dig on the resources for having not presented themselves.
Yeah.
So part of the job of government is to make available to the people, its constituents, all of the tools they need to live a better life. In the case of Altadena, the average value of a single family home is $1.3 million. Most people who live there couldn't afford to buy their own home in the current market. But at the same time, that $1.3 million in real estate could be $5 million in real estate with the proper guidance. And so part of the challenge here is that people don't know what's possible. Most people have never heard of any of the state bills or assembly bills. They don't understand the density perspectives of the state and the county and the initiatives that are associated with them. And so in order to support the population there, we have to support them with knowledge and we have to support them with administrative support.
You know, oftentimes when people hear Black community, they also, for some reason, hear the word poor. But Altadena was not that. This is California's first middle-class Black community, yes?
Sure. We think it was and still is. When we think of Black excellence, in Southern California and LA County, we tend to think of Ladera and, you know, some areas around. But Altadena sort of is off the list. But I think it's kind of intentional in a way. It's sort of like this low-key kind of place to escape to. It's not pretentious. A lot of the homes are turn of the century and have a lot of characters, a lot of craftsman homes and old Spanish-style homes and so forth. But it's less about the built environment and about the built community. The community in Altadena, the ownership of 81%, a lot of it is really because people didn't leave. They liked to be there. And so they stayed generation after generation. And so it gives you time, even though African-American accumulated wealth is 12 cents on the dollar to the majority population, people are able to pay off their real estate because they stayed generation after generation. And they didn't borrow against their homes in many cases. So a lot of the homes there were owned free and clear, which actually brings up another issue. If you don't have a mortgage company, no one's compelling you to have homeowners insurance. So a lot of the vulnerability to the fire is also due to the thing that makes Altadena so great.
You know, I wanted to talk to you about this because we talked about this a little bit before we started this interview. What are some of the barriers to rebuilding when race comes into play?
So if you think about at the same time that homes were burning in Palisades, they were also burning in Altadena. The area around Palisades in Malibu, for instance, seems like it has fires, wildfires, almost every year, followed by mudslides. We had fire up in Paradise. We've had fires running rampant, mostly in non-urban areas that are mostly majority population and not African American. Because of those fires in those high-risk areas, or higher-risk areas, I should say, insurance companies have been pulling out and raising rates and making it more difficult for people to have insurance in areas mm-hmm. like Altadena or Ladera or, frankly, anywhere else. But if you're dealing with a population that has accumulated wealth of 12 cents on the dollar, and then you ask them to pay elevated insurance premiums because of what has happened in more affluent areas, there's an issue, you know, of equity there in, you know, in how that that plays out. But if it's not just about the insurance rates, it's also about the withdrawing of insurance coverage, State Farm leaving, you know, the state and so forth. So, you know, all of these things sort of come together in this disastrous moment where people have, you know, these $1.3 million homes that they couldn't replace any other place that isn't carrying insurance. And we have a 98 mile an hour firestorm coming through. And none of it started with, I mean, obviously you should hold insurance on your home no matter what, if you can. But the if you can part is mm-hmm. the difficult part. Mm-hmm. Not everyone can.
What about people who didn't have insurance? Are there any realistic avenues for them to take when it comes to rebuilding?
Yeah, so there are. People have a choice of a number of things. And it's important to realize that everyone's not in the space where they want to rebuild for one reason or another. So when the fire came, people had their homes for sale for whatever reason. There were other people who were already in escrow. There were people going through a divorce. There were people who were in foreclosure. I mean, all of the things that happen in life were all happening when the fire hit. And so part of this is figuring out how to create a path forward for all of those scenarios. But for those who want to rebuild and weren't covered by insurance, mm-hmm. they do have some options. So FEMA provides money. Many of them had GoFundMe accounts and so forth. But then there's also construction lending. So if you own the vacant lot and you want to add value to it, a vacant lot in Altadena, I think the first one sold for about $450,000. So if you can imagine you have a home that's worth average value $1.3 million and you have a $400,000 lot paid for, then you can get a construction loan to build an improvement on that land. Mm-hmm. You now have a mortgage where you didn't before, but you can rebuild. Yeah. And in that case, especially, I would recommend taking that construction loan to max out the property with value so that you can sell off part of it and live there for free if you'd like, or just use the equity, you know, as liquid cash to invest. But, you know, in that case, that's a, you know, a perfect sort of case study for why it's important to have the option to develop.
You know what I want to ask you? I think you're the perfect person to ask. For people listening outside the area who are not familiar with Altadena, what do they need to understand the most about this community, especially in this moment?
Yeah, I think that Altadena is an incredible case study, not just for its community, but for California more broadly. A lot of the legislation that we have now allows for increased density, but there's still a lot of local pushback. Using Altadena as a case study, I developed there in Altadena and found, you know, sort of some of the setbacks oppressive, especially in West Altadena. So the code says that you're supposed to, or the zoning says that you're supposed to maintain the front setback. That's the average of the front yards on that block. Well, some developer who decided they wanted to sell set those setbacks, you know, in 1940 or 48 or 50. For some reason now, we feel it's important to maintain what that developer did as a sales tactic, which is essentially a taking of someone's front yard that could be used for whatever they want to use it for. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, some of this as a case study in Altadena could be applied more broadly, that right now, people were struggling for housing density. We're struggling to create enough units and to use what we have. Adding ADUs and all these types of things, you know, sort of ease the pain. But we're skipping past some of the most obvious opportunity. Why do we need this big open space in the front? Why can't we have an attached garage that has the same setback as a detached garage? A lot of these codes just are oppressive. And if we can sort of remove the fetters and let people develop out their land to its highest and best use in utilitarian fashion, then it becomes a higher highest and best use as a financial asset class.
And I want to just get a little personal you grew up in Altadena, and now the neighborhood that you called home is gone. Talk to me about what that is like on a personal level.
I didn't think it would affect me the way that it did. My wife and I both grew up in the area. And so our friends from school, our neighbors, our church family, everyone was there. And most of who we know who were still there lost their homes. Mm-hmm. I think 30 some odd families from our church, people we went to high school with and like that. I started traveling up to Altadena. I'm now down in the peninsula, but I started traveling up to Altadena as soon as it happened and public meetings started. And so at first, of course, we couldn't get into Altadena. And so we'd come to Pasadena and the meetings were close to the border and we could smell the smoke and ash. It wasn't until maybe, 2 weeks almost later before we were able to really drive through. And I'd already seen the aerial photos from CNN, I thought I was prepared. But nothing prepares you for actually being present in that place in that way. It looks like someone went to war against the neighborhood. And I couldn't help but sort of understand the parallels between what happened there and what happened in other places like Greenwood and Mount Bayou and Rosewood. I mean, so many places that were deliberately burned to the ground. And I can only imagine what it would be like to watch someone light your home on fire and your neighbor's house on fire. Clearly, this wasn't a deliberate act of terrorism, but it was negligence. And some could argue it was deliberate negligence. Edison received phone calls that the sparks were flying and then the winds were high and the power was still on until the 98 mile an hour winds were blowing the fire through Altadena. If you see the aerial photos during the fire, it seems like the entire city is on fire at the same time. There's no fire line to fight for the fire to fight. And knowing that the wind is moving at 98 miles an hour, you can imagine what that was like on the ground for people who were stuck there and were trying to get out. And so it moved me deeply. I think, my first few times through there, I was choked up and, I'm not going to admit on camera that I was crying, but it was harsh.
There's no shame in that. This is emotional. It's personal. That just shows how deeply you care. So thanks for being real with us, right? So in episode 3, we talked about how the warnings came too late for many. How the West Side didn't receive an alert until 8 hours after the East. And some people can't help but wonder, was that a mistake or was that something more intentional?
I think one of the hardest parts of being Black in America in current time, or I shouldn't say one of the hardest, maybe one of the most present elements is always questioning. Mm-hmm. You don't know what was incidental or what was intentional. So, when you get pulled over, do I get pulled over because I'm Black? When I don't get alerted, my house burns down, did that happen because I'm Black? And I'm sure that anyone who's not Black is always thinking, well, why are you always? But it's because history always bears out over and over and over again how some of, so many things were intentional. Now, I don't have any evidence that this was intentional, and I want to believe that it's not. But it doesn't mean that the systemic issues don't still result in the same thing. For people to be not alerted, for the power not to be cut, all of these things are, they point to systemic issues that put lives in danger and certainly people's homes in danger. I do want to bring up a really important aspect of Altadena, though. Altadena is often referred to as an African-American story because of the impressive African-American population. But the population of Altadena that is African-American is less than 20%. It's not that Altadena is mostly African-American. It's that the African-American population that's there is outstanding. And so it's part of the complexity of this is that as we talk about it as an African-American community, the resources are being withheld because of systemic racism that doesn't want to give money to you know, to an African-American community. But the white families and the Latino families, and there's actually a significant Japanese population in Altadena as well, they are all suffering along with the African-American community. Now, I want to clarify. I said resources are being withheld. I'm not talking about necessarily money, but I will say that when we had a visit from the president of the United States to come and see the affected areas, the president landed and walked and toured one area, but not the other. And I don't find it to be coincidence that African-American stories were the narrative around Altadena, and we didn't see a visit from the president of the United States. So the resources, attention, and whatever else. I don't have any actual metrics to, but I can see exactly what's happening as it's happening in real time.
So when we talk about the rebuilding process itself, from your knowledge, what does that timeline actually look like?
Yeah. So this type of disaster isn't brand new, unfortunately. And every time we go through one of these, we in Hawaii, in Paradise, the emergency response teams learn and improve. And so the hope is that they'll be faster than they were in Hawaii, which was actually faster in a lot of ways than it was up in Paradise. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of moving parts. So with the new administration, there's been, you know, shakeups in leadership. And so it's hard to know exactly, you know, how things will play out. But I think that one thing that we can be sure of is that in an area with $1.3 million homes decimated, resources are available, whether they're private funds or public funds or insurance claims. Resources are available to rebuild. The key is actually in how people are educated to be able to do that, whether they're displaced. And so the question was really about timeline. And so the timeline changes depending on who's doing the developing. It's going to be slower for people to develop themselves. On that, I'd give it, you know, between the 5 and 10 year mark for a lot of people to actually develop their own property and be finished with it. If a developer comes in and scoops up your land, they can have an expedited permit and have it done within 18 months.
So I read somewhere that 57% of Black homeowners in Altadena are over the age of 65. So how does that timeline work for them?
If you are an older person and your primary interest is in legacy, then you may be developing, but you're probably not developing for yourself.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. You're passing it down to your family.
You're passing it down. Maybe your primary interest is nostalgia because that's the place where you raised your family and you want to preserve that almost, shrine to your family. That's a legitimate cause, you know. So people have to determine what's most important to them. In the end, regardless of our emotional attachment, real estate is an asset class. As a developer myself, I think of it like a bond. You have a purchase price, outgoing cash flow, and then it has accumulated value moving forward. In the case of a home, it appreciates naturally with inflation, but it also has incoming cash flows. So you might think if you live in it, it doesn't have incoming cash flows, but it does. It actually has your rent that you would be paying as the incoming cash flow because you're actually consuming the service of shelter from that asset. Mm-hmm. Now, I said all that technical stuff specifically for this reason. If you understand real estate as an asset class and you're in this moment, you have this unique opportunity to increase the value of your asset. That's the non-emotional way to look at it. It's not devoid of emotion because these are people's homes. But if you can put those two things together and say, look, I'm going to build a new home for myself, and I'm also going to increase the value as an asset, I'm going to learn how to do that, then I think that's, for me, that would be the winning way to go.
Yeah.
Dr. Munson, again, thank you so much for having this conversation with me. Before we go, I'd love to hear your vision. What does the future of Altadena look like through your eyes?
Altadena Strong isn't just a slogan. It's actually sort of a through line, from grandmas to, you know, to moms and dads to, you know, to their children. Most of the people that I know from Altadena that I went to high school with that are still there, they fit into that narrative, and they're not going anywhere. They're going to rebuild. The way I see it going forward, in the most positive way, is that people max out the value of their property and they become millionaires on this tragedy. But they use this opportunity to build a home, not the same home that they were in, but build a home that has more usability, that has more energy efficient materials, more sustainable with solar panels and EV charging, multiple units that are income properties. All of this can happen rather than putting back what was there. That's what I see as the brass ring. Hopefully, it'll happen that way. I don't have as much say so. I don't live in Altadena anymore, but I'm there for my people, and I am available to try to help people to move on and move on in a way that provides that genuine generational wealth.
And last question for people who want to connect with you or learn more, where can they find you?
Yeah, MussonFactory.com is the website. And if you get there, you'll find a bunch of stuff. Our primary customer pool is government. Mm-hmm. So skip past all that stuff if you like and go directly to the contact page. And then someone on my staff will find that message and get it to me.
Well, Dr. Munson, we appreciate you for sharing your heart, your wisdom, and your deep connection to Altadena. This bonus episode is exactly what To Altadena with Love is all about, honoring the past, making sense of the present, and holding space for what's next. Make sure you download and follow the podcast wherever you listen and head to altadenawithlove.com to hear more about the series. I'm Mimi Brown. Thanks for tuning in. This is To Altadena with Love.
I'm Soledad O'Brien, and on my new true crime podcast, Murder on the Towpath, I'm taking you back to 1964, to the cold case of artist Mary Pinchot Meyer.
She had been shot twice in the head and in the back.
It turns out Mary was connected to a very powerful man.
I pledge you that we shall neither commit nor provoke aggression.
John F. Kennedy. Listen to Murder on the Towpath with Soledad O'Brien on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Yo, K-pop fans, are you ready? It's your boy, Bomhan, and I'm bringing you the K-Factor, the podcast that takes you straight into the heart of K-pop. We're talking music, idols, exclusive interviews, and even the real behind-the-scenes K-pop stories. Plus, you, the fans, you're part of the show. And you can get a chance to jump in, share your opinions, and be part of the conversation like never before. And trust me, you never know where we might pop up next. So listen to the K-Factor starting on April 16 on iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. This isn't just a podcast. It's a K-pop experience. Are you in? Let's go.
Let's go.
If money is a taboo topic and nobody wants to talk about it, how can we be educated on something we're unwilling to talk about?
April is Financial Literacy Month, and Black Tech Green Money is where culture meets capital. Each week, I sit down with Black entrepreneurs and leaders to share their blueprint for building generational wealth through tech, innovation, and ownership.
Once we know more, we can have more. One thing is we tell our clients is the more that you learn, the more that you earn, but you have to be willing to learn.
To hear this and more game-changing insight, listen to Black Tech Green Money on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
70% of Americans are living from paycheck to paycheck. Not Black people, not brown people, everybody. And whether you're white, black, red, brown, or yellow, you want to see some more green. Can I get an amen?
Hey, this is Financial Literacy Awareness Month. Tune in to Money and Wealth with John O'Brien, a podcast that breaks down financial freedom in a way that's real, relatable, and rooted in empowerment. From rebuilding your credit to starting your wealth journey, I give you all the tools to rise.
I'm going to break down how the modern economy works. This is what they never taught you in school. You're not dumb and you're not stupid. It's what you don't know that you don't know is killing you, but you think you know.
To hear this and more practical wisdom, open your free iHeartRadio app, search Money and Wealth with John Hope Bryant, and start listening today.